Hi, my name is John Light, and I've spent over 20 years working throughout all corners of the recruiting world. Our podcast, Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool, is a resource to help you stay afloat and get ahead of your competition. Hi, and welcome to another episode in Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool. I'm here today with Dylan Robbins. With Lucra Sports, I'm John Light, president of Sabretooth Recruiting, and your host here. And I only talked to Dylan a short while ago, and a lot has transpired since then. But I was very excited to have him come on the show today. And one of the big reasons, Dylan, and I hope by way of introduction, you can talk about this a little bit, but this really intriguing tech platform you've developed with called Lucra Sports.
Absolutely. And John, thank you to you and your team for having me on today. It's a pleasure. Looking forward to chatting all things Lucra and all things tech and hiring and recruiting. Simply put, Lucra, you know, we're trying to change the game in the way that friends wager with friends, right? I think that, you know, it's been clear to me over the past decade that the proliferation of betting and sports betting has been huge. But I think what's been missing is that there's, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans who enjoy friendly competition, you know, a game of horse after school, or you go to the pub and you play foosball or cornhole or darts, or, you know, a fitness challenge or a video game or a board game, you name it. And there's so many competitive, you know, friendly and competitive experiences happening. And we think there's hundreds of billions of dollars wagered offline on these things. You know, every golf cart, you know, there's imagine how much money is going through those transactions. So Lucra's goal is to digitize and gamify that environment. And we sell software that allows brands and teams and leagues and in-person entertainment businesses and consumer technology companies to gamify their friendly consumer experiences. So you can partner up with Lucra and we'll provide all the legal work, the compliance, the UI, the UX, the payments, the banking, and a contest engine to allow your customers to engage with each other in real money contests. So excited to talk through some of these examples and things that we're doing, and just, you know, really looking forward to our conversation today.
Man, the first time we spoke, I'm going through my head, I don't gamble. There's a lot of stuff I don't do that people go, well, you're a little odd. You know, I mean, I fish and I like to be outdoors and this sort of thing. But when you started explaining to me kind of the thesis about, okay, this is where we started from, this is where we're taking this, I sat there scratching my head. And I don't know, because I remember it was a video call. I don't know if you could see the wheels turning and the smoke coming out of my ears. So I'm thinking, wow, because I know so many people that if they're on a golf course, even if it's $5 a hole, there's a bet going on and it's going for 18 holes. If they're out fishing, it's who's going to get the big fish. If they're, you know, like you said, it's a fitness thing. It's like, how many miles of this, or did you beat the speed? I mean, it's crazy. And I know you talk about the monetization of it, but I'm sure you could probably have other things worked in there that are non-monetary, you know, like prizes or events or whatever to the winner, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So first, I think you bring up a great point. One of my favorite, you know, dinner party parlor tricks is like, you know, go up to someone, you know, I'm the weird guy who's like, you know, hey, are you a sports bettor? Do you bet on things? Because I'm just interested to know, like, anytime I meet people out, that's a consumer feedback opportunity, mm-hmm. right? So I'm asking around, I'm saying, and when people say no,
absolutely,
which is pretty common, right? So if I came up to you, John, at a party, and I said, hey, John, do you bet? And you said, nah, I'm not really a big gambler, right? I said, okay, well, what do you like to do in your free time? You know, what are you good at, right? And you may say, hey, I'm an angler. I love to fish, right? And then I'll say, well, hey, would you bet your buddy on who's going to catch a larger fish today? You'd probably say, yeah, sure, $5 on that, no problem, right? So everybody has their thing that they believe in, that they're comfortable mm-hmm. with, that they're, you know, that they're, like, you know, inspired by. And at Lucra, we're trying to just bring the technology to that. So to your point, it doesn't always have to be for money, right? You know, could I say for 20, you know, instead of $20, could I say, hey, I'll bet you a burger, right? Like, I'll bet you a burger at the pub that I can hit a bullseye before you, right? And like the whole idea of, let's break down those barriers, let's destigmatize, you know, kind of recreational wagering for casual fans. It doesn't have mm-hmm. to be money. It could be loyalty points. It can be court time on a pickleball match. It could be, you know, a sleeve of Pro V1s after a round of golf, right? There's a lot of ways that we could gamify this experience for fans outside of just, you know, real money itself.
It's like adding another dimension of entertainment in a way that you don't need a bookie to do. You know, it's not illegal or anything. And you're not relying necessarily on people to, in good faith. I mean, we all try to track that stuff, but, you know, once out of sight, out of mind. So, I mean, the concept itself and the way you've described, you know, your go to market and how you've been developing things is just fascinating to me, because like I said, as soon as you told me what it was and the concept behind it, my mind just started working on, wow, there are so many places, so many events, so much, even mundane everyday events where this sort of thing could be put to use. And I know that's not where the first place people go, but it just shocked me thinking about, wow, how pervasive lucre sports could end up being.
And that's one of our challenges as a company is it's almost too broad of a market, right? It fits everywhere. And we can't do, right? It's not a realistic mm-hmm. market strategy to say, hey, we're going to own fitness and recreational sports and video games and board games and, you know, you name it, right? And so it's like, hey, a big part of our goals for 2024 is narrow in that focus. You know, where are we the best fit for now and then grow to become ubiquitous with kind of friendly and casually, you know, gamifying these experiences. And I think a big part of that is mm-hmm. partnering with brands and companies that already have a lot of competition happening in their platform, right? So find a brand where people are already competing in this ecosystem. They're probably already wagering outside of this ecosystem with each other, and just let's provide the technology to make that happen, right? And so pickleball is a great example, right? You know, the pickleball ecosystem, 50 million Americans are playing pickleball. People are wagering on pickleball. It's happening all over the country, right? And so we know that it's happening. So let's provide gamification into the Major League Pickleball and Duper ecosystem to allow for this, you know, really digitized experience for an offline thing, right? And to your point, people don't settle up. There's no lifelong leaderboards. There's no head-to-head stats. And Lucre solves that problem. You've got a digital mm-hmm. leaderboard and a payment ledger with all your friends for everything that you've ever competed on. And I think that's pretty cool.
I don't know if I want all that history on me out there if I'm one of those people.
Yeah, it's true. There's no coming back. There's no more he said, she said. You know, it's all out there now. Yeah. Yeah.
Or you tell your wife, oh, no, I don't know why there's so much money missing from the account. I don't know why all that happened. And then she goes, let me see your history.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, exactly.
So truth be told, let's talk about that for a second. So if I'm out there in the world and I listen to this podcast, for example, and I'm like, okay, Lucre Sports sounds really incredible. How do I get engaged with Lucre Sports? I mean, is it an individual thing? Is there, like you said, an ecosystem and pickleball or tournaments or fitness that I would get involved in or be aligned with that I could make use of it?
100%. So there's two ways. You know, first, if you can always download the Lucre app, we have a Lucre app in the iOS store and the Android store. You can, you know, download it, challenge your friends, invite your friends, pretty much anything you can think of. All the things we've mentioned, you know, fishing, golf, pickleball, you name it, it's on there, right? So you can challenge your friends that way. But also what we probably recommend is go find one of our partners and go engage through their ecosystem. For example, if you're a tennis fan, go find Tennis One, which, you know, we think one of the fastest growing tennis apps in the US and globally, and try our product within the Tennis One platform, because you're going to find additional cool features that really fit the tennis world mm-hmm. if you use one of our partners, right? You know, scores and stats and other gamified experiences and live streams, all that layered on to the Lucre experience. And so we think the best way to experience our product is through partner brands. But if you're looking to just try our app, you can always go download it on the App Store and the iOS Store as well.
Awesome. And if I wanted to find out what partner brands, I could check out your website or?
Yeah, go to our website, www.lucresports.com. You know, Google us, try us in the news. We're launching new brands every month. We launched just two this month alone, and we have some really big ones coming soon in January and February. So yeah, check out our website, and it's a great place to find out where you can find Lucre and where you can challenge your friends.
I want people to know about that, man, because you got me a little pumped up about the whole platform. And, you know, and I know that part of our underlying theme here when we get on Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool is also talk about the intersection of talent and technology, or talent and career, or talent and, in this case, you know, this entrepreneurial idea that you had to put together. And, you know, when we were talking the other day, we're talking about how much technology goes into this one discrete transaction or event, you know, and all the work it takes to build up to it. And so I'm curious, with something like Lucre Sports, you know, Dylan, what kind of challenges have you guys run into relative to not just acquiring the quality talent, especially tech talent you need, but keeping it engaged and keeping the historicity of what you've developed and are developing in the family?
Yeah, no, it's a really, really, really good question. And as you said, we could talk a long time about this and go into a lot of detail. I mean, I think at the start, we really struggled with the question of what do you build and what do you buy, right? I mean, that's a really age-old question mm-hmm. for early-stage tech companies and entrepreneurs. It's expensive to build things yourselves, right? There's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of bugs. Right. You got to bring people internally. But you also take a lot of risk by buying things externally. You don't get to own that brand. You don't get to own that user experience. Sometimes it's not, you know, it's not always an ideal situation. So we had to try and find that balance early of build versus buy. And over time, as we've grown, we really mm-hmm. kind of felt that our technology, our proprietary technology, is one of our greatest value assets. And so right now we try to build internally at Lucro. We have an amazing technology and product and design organization, close to 15 people at the company remotely across the US. And it's been a huge part. One of the most important parts of our success is the early engineers and product and design folks we brought onto our team. Our product is our company, mm-hmm. right? We sell software. So if our product doesn't work, we don't have any value, right? And so building technology fast, breaking it, fixing it, being agile, all that comes with having the right people and retaining those people and making sure that Lucro is a great place to work. So happy to dive into any of those pieces individually. It's been a huge part of our journey and a key area of focus going forward. We're going to hire about a dozen people next year. And that's a big part of my job is spending that time and that energy getting that right.
All right. Selfishly hearing that, recruiter hat comes on and it goes, yes, tell me more. But I'm really interested in knowing, is when you look back over the last couple of years, the marketplace or tech talent has been experiencing some evolutions. Can we say it that way? Kind of an economic cycle compression in a sense, but it's exacerbated by Gen AI and people looking at it and going, wow, can I replace my coders? Can I replace my development team? Can I replace these admins? Can I replace HR? All this other sort of stuff. And, with this podcast, I've interviewed people who are at the pinnacle of corporate America, as far as, a CTO, CIO, Fortune 500 type company folks. And they have a very different view of technology today than the risk benefit against someone like you. So when you go out and you look for talent, I'm curious to know, what's the narrative or what's the story that helps you position Lucro Sports advantageously against all the other competitors for that talent in the marketplace?
Yeah, it's a good question and it's a big part of my role. First of all, what I'll say just at the outset is when we go to hire people, the things we say first are we're looking for people with grit and tenacity, loyalty, and positive energy. And I don't think AI can do those things just yet. We'll get to the point when we can, that'll be an interesting day. We'll have another call about that. But I just think that technical skills are never the first 5 or 10 things on our job descriptions, right? Like we want people who are bought in on Lucro. They love our vision. They understand what we're trying to achieve. They want to be part of a team. They want to be part of something special. And I think that kind of gets to your question is, we're still a small growing team. Everyone at our company wears a lot of hats. Everyone at our company has a lot of responsibility. Everyone in our company is an equity partner and owner and is aligned in our business goals and objectives. And so I think a big part of what we pitch to talent is, come be part of something that could be really special and own a lot of that, right? Like it's a very flat organization. We don't have a lot of process and structure in terms of, bureaucracy and hierarchy. Everybody is contributing in a big and valuable way. And the communication lines are very open and very flat. So I think, while we don't, can't pay what some of the big tech players can pay, and we can't offer some of the incredible crazy benefits that you see out in the market today at some of the top tech firms in the world, what we can offer, I think, is a rewarding lifestyle and a real rewarding job experience and really being part of something where your code, what you're writing, what you're designing, what you're developing, you're seeing it day in and day out in the product.
Well, and you've got a fail faster attitude, right? So the iterative process, being able to iterate and see, okay, this works, that doesn't work, and so on and so forth, which to me that's part of the excitement of pioneering something, isn't it?
Totally.
That you get in there and you have this lessons learned opportunity that's not something necessarily duplicatable in a lot of large companies.
Yeah, look, it's been hard. Something that's been hard for me as a non-technical leader is that getting accustomed to just breaking stuff and failing at, right? It's like, on the technical side, you don't understand that to get something right, you kind of got to get it wrong a few times, right? Like in terms of how you build an architect and trial and error.
Maybe more than a few.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's been a really cool learning for me, and also something that I think is the downfall of a lot of medium-sized companies, right? Like I think if you don't have insane product market fit and you're kind of in that in-between size, you lose some of that ability to innovate and be flexible and break things because you have this large growing customer base. Once you get to a significant enough scale, you kind of get through that interim piece. But we do agile sprints. We do, every 2 weeks we're writing new code, we're developing new features, we're deploying new app releases, and we're getting feedback from our customers, and we can do that in a pretty fast real-time experience as a small company, which is exciting.
So let me ask, when you look for someone, grit, tenacity, of energy, loyalty. I think those are I think those are great qualities, you know, and grit. I might have used something synonymous like resilience, right? Can you bounce back? Because it's not about what happens to us, it's how we react to it. But tenacity is one of those things I think a lot of people, I think it's hard to find, right? Because tenacity is Thomas Edison, who, after failing 1,000 times to invent the light bulb, somebody says, well, what's next? You know, you failed all these times. There's not a way to do it. He says, no, I've just found 1,000 ways it couldn't be done.
Right.
And maybe the next one will happen, or the next one. And, you know, that spirit of not just entrepreneurship, but I think of pioneering exploration and development, that's hard to quantify. You know, you could make an argument that you could try to quantify energy levels and loyalty and maybe even grit or resilience. But tenacity is one of those things where some people do it automatically, but it's really an act of will.
Yeah. And it's a really hard thing to interview for.
One way or the other, I'm going to get it done.
And it's a really hard thing to interview for because there's no metric for it, right? And so you're trying to get a sense just from meeting people from a culture standpoint and getting an understanding. Are they, you know, does this person have that type of attitude? Because to your point, there's an entrepreneurial side to engineering that I think is really interesting to like, and you have to have that tenacity and that ability to think outside the box and not be flustered by something not working out the first time. And, you know, also riding that line of trying to hit business objectives and milestones and deadlines while also trying to build things in the right way for the future of the company and voicing that to the leadership. And, you know, I think it's what makes technology recruiting so difficult, especially because a lot of tech recruiting at early stage startups is not done by technical people. Like, that's, I think, a really interesting point to make. Like, you know, when you get to, you know, Series B, Series C, Series D, you know, you have, you know, real structure and process in place. But let's call it, like, you know, day one, you know, when Lucra first started, pre-seed, you know, seed, even Series A, maybe there's one or two technical leaders that are doing the hiring, but a lot of the hiring is being done by sometimes not a super technical person, right? And so I think that makes it even more complicated to get to you know, the right outcome at times. And that's why, you know, leaning on those folks that you do have is critical.
Well, it's funny you'd say that because we did a survey, man, a little over a year ago, where one of the biggest complaints talent acquisition leaders had, executives, was that they didn't have internal teams that understood tech well enough to recruit for tech. And that's not to say they all needed to be able to code in Python or do data science or whatever it might be, but rather that they didn't understand what good looks like.
Totally. What's the benchmark?
I think even if you're non-technical, understanding, okay, if this is a role I've got to fill and you got to define the role, you also got to define what does good look like for that role. And that may be an example profile. It may be an example resume or someone who's done a similar role or that role previously, but those are two steps you can't ignore. And I think the challenge a lot of people run into, and you've probably seen it yourself, is, okay, we're building this company and we're defining these roles, but there's not enough put into that definition on the front end. And in terms of looking down, okay, here's where we are today. Here's where we need to be. What does this role need to do in order to get us there? And sometimes that's just not, I don't know that it's necessarily defined enough by non-technical people.
Yeah.
In conjunction with technical, obviously, but really understanding that. Because if you don't understand that, odds are very strong you're going to miss on a hiring decision.
You could lose before you even start. You know, and we, you know, that's that, if you don't have the right, not only the right structure for that role, but how that role is going to interact with the other roles that you have at the company, right? You could accidentally, you know, get into a situation where you're double layering and you have people both thinking they're doing the same role when they're actually doing slightly different things, and just being really communicative. And that's something that we're continuing to get better at, and just making sure that we have like really outlined hiring plans. And also, to your point, having good structure and process. I think that's one thing that's also really grown for us since day one. Day one hiring process was a couple calls with me, right? And I think that now we have a full team. You know, we have case studies and work studies, and we have each interview is focused on a certain thing. So one person will interview and focus on collaboration. One person will ask about prior work experience. You know, one person will talk about why Lucra and what's interesting for you. One person will talk about the case study and like really make sure that we're not doing four duplicative interviews talking about the same thing with four different people and really trying to test and target the right type of stuff. Like those little things, I think, make a big difference in getting the right person and really making it clear what that person's going to be working on.
So there's a really, really good book, and I don't normally show for book on this show because this is not a sales podcast by any stretch. It's a fun podcast, and it's hopefully giving people tactics and strategies that they can apply. But there's a book by a guy named, I'm looking at it actually on my bookshelf back behind my computer, that written by a guy named Bradford Smart called Top Grading. Mm. And to me, it's almost the Bible of interviewing and assessing talent. If you ever have a chance to grab that and read it, I mean, his interview process, what he prescribes is in depth,
wow,
to put it politely. One of the things I like about it is he's a big believer in what we talked about, you know, understanding what the role really is, defining, but also defining what good looks like before you start a search and before you start interviewing. Because if you don't know what good looks like, you're just kind of flying blind and totally, you're guessing. And to your point, you could end up with duplications, or you could actually end up totally missing the target because you're going in different directions on roles. But yeah, it's a heck of a read. I know there's a lot of different interview techniques, and people go and they could do behavioral interviews, or they do, you know, skills-based interviews and all this. But one of the things I've found that's just crucial is I love having people with enough experience to understand their pattern of behavior in their career. And even if I have to start at the back bottom of the last page of a resume and work my way forward, understanding their motivations for each position they left and for each position they took on up the ladder. And one of the keys I've always found is I look for inconsistencies. But the problem with it, in my opinion, is just like defining that target to begin with and defining that role in order to define the target, it requires a serious investment of brain power and time.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know about you, but crafting job descriptions, I do it for clients all the time, but it's not exactly one of my, well, this is the holiday season. It's not one of my few of my favorite things at all, but it's something that I think you really have to do to be accurate. And I like the idea that you've segmented the interview for focus. I'm curious, though, if you do that individually or via panel, or what the preferred vehicle is to accomplish that.
Yeah. So what we do is we set the hiring manager for the role. So for example, if we're hiring someone on our backend engineering team, our VP of engineering would be the hiring manager. He would then go ahead and set up, okay, here are the four or five people that I think need to meet this person. And here's how I would structure, you know, okay, you know, X person has been on our team the longest. So maybe he should be talking about the Y Lucra and maybe talking about the role itself. And you know, maybe this person is a little bit newer, but he actually has quite relevant job experience to the person that we're hiring, or, and so maybe that person can ask about, you know, previous job experience. So the hiring manager will set that up and then provide sample questions to the team and say, hey, here are the couple of things that are, you know, a framework sample. You don't have to follow this, but just some ideas. And then we have a candidate scorecard where everyone on our team will consistently in the same way score the candidate. So it'll be a one, which is, you know, I'm 100% out, not for me. A two, which is I'm interested, but I need to learn more. A three is I'm interested, I think we should move forward. And a four is stop what you're doing. Stop, drop, and roll. We need this person on the team right now.
Get an offer out the door.
Yeah, exactly. So most people, as you'd imagine, ended up in twos or threes, but it's always helpful if there's ever a couple ones or a couple fours, you expedite the process in one way or the other, right? You quickly move away from the candidate, or you quickly move forward to, hey, we got to really focus on this. This is somebody the team is saying can be really valuable for us. So we try to add some, by the way, I'll be the first one to admit it. This is not how it always worked. This is a new thing for us over the past 6 months. Like we've evolved into this, right? Like it was not this way for many, many years. So I think it just takes time. And I would say to counter that, over process can be a problem for small companies as well, right? This is working for us now at 15, 20 people.
It can kill it for the candidate, for sure.
It can kill it for the candidate, right? And so not over processing and being efficient. And that entire process I mentioned, we try and do in a week or 10 days, right? So it's not like we're keeping the candidate lagging and waiting. We're moving quickly through these processes to keep that experience going positively.
Well, and it's good that you're conscientious around the timing, you know, because a big complaint a lot of candidates had, well, I have five interviews at company X or company Y or Z, and, you know, and never heard they ghosted me. I never heard back from them. But I think one of the things that people miss is that when you interview a candidate, in my opinion, I could be wrong, but in my opinion, you generally know in the first 90 seconds or so that, okay, I like this person or I don't. You know, and then you spend the rest of the 30 or 45 minutes or whatever trying to buttress that one way or the other. And it's very hard. And it's a people thing. I think it's very hard to stay neutral. You know, so you really have to have your eyes on the price and off the price, so to speak. But the scorecard idea, I will tell you this. I use them. And I think anyone in a hiring position doing any kind of talent acquisition, you know, if you're going to be sophisticated and keep up, you need a scorecard. But I don't like overly complex scorecards. I like scorecards that are simple. I like maybe five-ish areas that I'm going to score consistently, because what I've found is if you take somebody, you develop a job description, and you say, okay, what's important on there? If it's just raw, they're going to sit there and check every box. And I don't like that, because that candidate probably doesn't exist. And then they feel like they're compromising to go get that candidate. But if you check the right skills that have certain critical career paths that will take them in contact with other skills they'll have needed to develop along the way in that chain, you solve a lot of those problems. And so if you just score on those, I think you're onto something. But some of those are, you know, to your point, intangible. You know, how do we measure tenacity or grit? And I think the best way is, you know, tell me about a timer. What's an example of this? And really good candidates, really, really bright ones, and the ones who listen to me and people like me when we tell them this, is they organize their resumes in a way that they address, how do they address specific problems, situation, task, action, result, and, you know, what quantified results they got. Because how they do those things is a real great idea of how they're going to carry forward with you.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And I think that it actually brings me to the kind of a question for you, John. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to interview you on your own podcast, but I have a question for you.
Yeah, feel free.
It is around, so obviously we've been talking a lot about the intangibles, which are, I think, critically important, hustle, grit, attitude, et cetera. But for technical recruiting, can't forget about the technical side, right? And these, you know, you need to hire people who can actually do the job that you're hiring them to do. And my question for you is, from your experience and with other founders you've talked to, when's the right point in that process to do the technical screen? Because the technical screen is a lot of work for both us and the candidate, right? It's, you know, sometimes 60, 92 hours, and we have to review those. And that's a lot of time on our team. So part of me says, hey, screen a bunch up front and only do that requirement, you know, with people you really care about, because it saves your team time. Part of me says, why even screen somebody if they don't match the technical areas of, you know, we have a lot of people that we like that we just find out too late in the process that they weren't the right technical fit. So what's your kind of balance on that when you give advice to your clients?
No, that's a terrific question. And I'm glad you asked it. Actually, I've worked with a client very closely over the past year, well, maybe 9 months or so, that, you know, we do a couple of interviews that kind of calibrate on personality fit, culture fit, and all this. And then we go to this technical two-hour interview where, you know, they were presented a problem with parameters and data. They had an hour to go work on it, and they wanted it preferably solved in Python or R or something. It was pretty simple. It shouldn't take more than an hour. And then half an hour to debrief, present results, and kind of almost have a dissertation defense, in a sense that you're sitting there asking questions, going back and forth. And I actually found it to be quite efficient, but also very challenging, because some candidates just aren't built to be put on a spot like that. You know, do code, write a program, send it for someone to look is different from going through it and saying, okay, we agree or we don't agree, because there's not a target. The target isn't, did you solve the problem? The target is, how did you go about solving the problem? And I think from a technical perspective, understanding how a person goes about solving problems might be more critical than the solutions they've come up with themselves, because it gives you a lot of insight about not just them, but how capable they are using those tools. And my suggestion would be one of two things. Number one, I would probably take technical assessments and try and find a way to split them off a little bit and have something maybe up front that's an email thing, or, you know, a page you had them go, a landing page they go to, and they can address a problem of some sort that lets you know, okay, this person, we can talk peer-to-peer, eye-to-eye on how we're going to address this coding challenge or this other technical challenge, whatever it might be. Then go in and do the assessments on the intangibles, and then do the bigger technical thing, because it's somewhere either before that first technical step or right after, you got to have an interview, I believe, that includes, if it's not totally this, it needs to at least include it, the why. Why are we a great place for someone to land at? Why would this make sense for you? And this is how we define our culture. And I define culture, generally speaking, as how we go about our business. Hey, candidate A, B, C, D, whoever, this is how Lucre Sports goes about its business. This is our culture. This is our lifeblood. We want to make sure you're aligned before we put you through a lot, or we are ourselves through a lot. You know, and then, like I said, either before or after, have that minor technical step. Okay, we're calibrated. Then that, set the hook, and then carry forward to the rest of the process. Because, you know, you do want to know if the team feels like they can integrate before you invest bunches of hours and resources into the technical piece. But at the same time, I would be very concerned if on your technical assessment, you had a very high fail rate. I would think by the time they get to that, there should be so few taking it, the odds of success, if they've been vetted properly and there's been some technical on the front end, the odds of success will go up. You know, maybe it's one out of four, maybe it's one out of 10. Please don't be one out of 100. That's painful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, John. That's
I don't know if that makes sense, and I'll take answers a question.
It makes a lot of sense, and I'll take it back to my team.
Yeah, no, and I like panel interviews too, by the way, for instead of back to back to back, because I like to see how people perform, you know, in environments that they may not be used to, especially. I got to get back to this. I think this is important. I always ask people, you know, about their passion project when we get close to the end of recording one of these podcasts, but I know you're passionate about darts. And I know you just came back
from a
big time international dart tournament. So I got to ask, A, how did it go? B, how much fun was it? And C, would you have something else out there in your orbit that you're so passionate about it overrides your dart passion?
I can start with number three. The answer is no. Darts is my passion for sure. I mean, so I'm a big darts player recreationally. Yeah, I play in the New York Dart League. I'm a big fan. I follow the Professional Darts Corporation. I'm just a big darts fan. And the U.S., you know, unfortunately, is not a big mecca for darts, right? Most darts are played internationally and in Europe and overseas. And so I don't get the chance to go to as many tournaments as I'd like. And a couple of my buddies and I said, you know what? This is the year. Let's go to the World Championships in London. So we went this past weekend to the Alexandra Palace for the World Championships. And I just got to say, whether you like darts or not, this was the place to be. We were sitting with each other, looking at each other, like tears in our eyes. And we said, this is the place to be in the world right now. This is the pinnacle. I mean, the energy in there is unbelievable. You know, 5,000-10,000 people. You know, the drinks are flowing, the darts are throwing, the energy is great, music everywhere. It's really a social experience to go watch the darts. So I highly recommend if you haven't before, go to a tournament. It was a lot of fun. As you mentioned at the beginning, I just recently got back. I'm still a little jet lagged. It was a long trip, had a few pints of Guinness, but we're good to be back and at the desk and back in action at Lucra.
Hey, Dylan, thanks so much for joining us today. Man, I think you've really got the tiger by the tail with Lucra Sports. I wish you all the best with that, man, and I look forward to talking with you again real soon.
You've been listening to Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool. This podcast is sponsored by Sabretooth. Sabretooth improves the quality of hire and speeds up the time to fill specialized machine learning, data engineering, data science, and developer roles, stretching tech recruiting budgets further by bringing the precision of retained search and the speed of contingent search to the market in one complete solution. Find out more at sbr2th.com and follow me, John Light, on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening.